How'd you think attendance was at MJ this year compared to last?
It's a little different from past years. A little slower.
I think it's like attendance is the lowest I've seen.
I would say so too. And even like the events, it's not the same. There's less culture-based events, more sales-based after parties and events versus doing stuff for the culture.
Yeah, the parties out here, it's like more of an event to go to than the actual show.
100%, yeah.
That's what it's turning into.
Yep.
You know, I think when they separated everything into different halls, it kind of threw it off a bit.
Yeah, made it more spread out. It's a lot of just moving around for people too, all day. And even for like people that are here, it's a long day. You're going all morning, all night.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I know a little bit of your story, but we've never gone that deep into it. Like when did you get into cultivating cannabis?
I got into it, it's probably been like 12, 13 years ago now. And, it was all by accident. I was managing restaurants in New York. Went to go visit my little brother out in Humboldt and, saw the farm. I was back in the good old gray days and I never left. I went back to New York, packed up all my stuff, came back and started moving dirt and learning how to grow.
That was it.
Yeah. Went from moving dirt to taking notes and working my way up and learning everything I could.
So you started cultivating in Humboldt. Were you on the mountain or?
Yeah, we were up outside of Willow Creek. So we were up on the hill.
Yeah.
And I went from no cultivation experience to running large scale, essentially commercial facility.
How big did you start off?
We started off the first year, it was only 6 like 100 by 30 greenhouses, and then I like half acre of full sun. And then we ended up with 12 of those greenhouses and then a full acre of full sun.
That was your first cultivation?
That was my first cultivation, yeah.
Wow, you didn't like no there's, one light, two light, four light.
There's no warm up.
Like full send.
Yeah.
And you know, were you always a greenhouse from day one?
Yeah, on the farm. Yeah, I always never. I got to skip all the trimming initiation part of it. So
she just went full cultivation.
Yep, straight to greenhouse. I could pull tarps and move dirt. So it was an attractive pull from them at the beginning.
Yeah, you told me some crazy thing. You know, once like they would give you like $60,000, right, for the season. And then would it just be you or a team?
So it was me. It was essentially me and my two brothers and my brother's best friend. We were the core people there. Team of three of us. We were the guys there every day. And then we bring in hourly labor for, you know, big pushes like harvest and stuff. But yeah, we essentially get a budget till that first harvest and we got that first weed trimmed and that was it.
So you get up on the mountain, you get your $60,000 for the year.
Yep.
Right? Is that what it was?
Yo, $60,000 probably for the first like till July. You start trimming that first, your first harvest.
So you gotta, no matter what, you gotta make that work.
You gotta make it work, yep. There's no options. You just figured it out and made it work.
Did you guys do outdoor up there too?
Yeah, we did outdoor. We did mixed light, pulled depths, and then we had, you know, just straight outdoor for live rosin.
Mixed light HPS?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're running 100,000 square feet in Nevada right now.
Yep.
And one of your biggest strengths that I see is you're really dialed in on irrigation strategy. Is that self-taught, just watching?
No, that was just I came back to Vegas after I left California, after I left Humboldt, and that's when it started coming on the scene and all the information started coming out about it. And I just dove straight in to learn as much as I could about it. And, you know, it all made sense. So I wanted to, you know, learn what I could to put it into practice.
Yeah. So you never did really solid irrigation strategy up in Humboldt, obviously, you know, by feel or whatever.
Yeah. It was by feel or by, you know, just schedules we'd put together. There's no science based reason to why we were feeding essentially versus having that live data where you can make day-to-day decisions.
I've heard some crazy stories up there, you know, about just crime and like, what was it like on the mountain?
You know? It was still the wild, wild west a couple of years ago. You know, I'm sure it's not what it was 20 years ago, but there's still a bunch of lawlessness that happens. There's reasons people live out in the middle of nowhere like that.
Yeah. Like, you being from New York, right?
Yep.
You know, coming out there, was it I mean, were you welcome in right away or?
No, I don't even think I would say I was welcome in till the day I left.
Really?
I mean, of course, like some of the local homie growers, but there's so many other outsiders and aspects of people. Like we didn't really socialize up there. There's like a little bar in town. I was there for 6-7 years on the hill and never went to that bar once. It was just something you didn't do. You didn't socialize around.
You didn't socialize.
No. I mean, and that's still kind of like on the end of like, what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a landscaper or yeah. We work construction.
Yeah.
It wasn't something you talked about in public. Like,
yeah,
there's always that risk of you being followed back to the farm. And
yeah, I remember hearing stories from you about just people disappearing and
yeah, all the time. It's even the gas station up there. It's a little tiny town of maybe like 800 people. There's probably like a missing posters for like 70 or 80 people. They're just all like from the month before.
What were like people from like trimmers coming there?
Yeah,
like
it was essentially like the big thing. They'll hire a bunch of labor and then just not pay them
like that.
Yeah, unfortunately.
What I know, you know, we used to get a lot of trimmers from like South America. Yep. And is that same up there?
Yeah, that was our crew. I mean, they come in and crush. And
yeah. Did you ever run into any problems?
No, we were pretty good about vetting our trimmers. And like, if you were messing up or doing stuff we didn't approve of, you're out of there right away. Like we didn't.
Yeah. Did you run into any issues with the locals with?
We had a couple of crazy locals, but nothing like we didn't handle. But yeah, definitely locals, and had people putting up gorilla grows on the back of our property, which was fun to try to get them to stop.
And then, so from Humble, you came straight out to Las Vegas.
Yeah, I came out to Vegas. I had an opportunity to go work with some guys that were coming out here from Humble. Their spot fell through, so I ended up working somewhere else.
Their Las Vegas spot?
Yeah.
Okay, so you came out
to work, yeah.
To work that spot.
Yep.
And then where'd you end up kind of planting the flag?
I ended up going to Shango. Wanted to work again. I was waiting for that spot to open forever and just no work. So
bored.
And then, you know, that was kind of towards the time of all this irrigation strategy. So I was like, I'm learning about all this stuff. And I want to put it into action. I need a place. I don't want to put up a little tent in my house. And so I ended up going there and then ended up meeting you, I think maybe 6 months into being at Shango.
Oh, so that's when you were there for 6 months.
Yeah.
And what was your role at Shango?
So I ended up just being their irrigation like specialist. So essentially all I would do all day is just monitor all the data, kind of come up with the formulas of our feed schedules and kind of build it on rooms and then keep that data and build it like per cultivar and help them kind of figure out that aspect of their grow.
And you just learned that by videos,
whatever information I could read. And then honestly, trial and error, you know, it sucks. You got to learn some hard lessons sometimes, but you don't know. There wasn't a lot of data out back then about it. So there's a lot of things like you had rough boundaries and you just had to try it and see if it worked out. If it didn't.
Yep. What were you guys? You guys in Rockwell, Coco? What were you guys at in Shinga?
We were Rock or Coco.
Coco?
Yeah. The 2 gallon like Dutchie bags.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And what do you like the journey of learning how to, you know, crop steer and kind of dial in the irrigation, what's your philosophy on it? Like, are you in line with everything like Arroya and we teach, or do you have your own little secret sauce?
I mean, I take all their stuff with, you know, as a good baseline. And then obviously as you grow and just tweak stuff here and there, there's certain strains that like to sit at a higher EC, certain strains that like a little more pH. So I would say I just have a little bit of my secret sauce of just tweaking it per strain and trying to dial them in as much as possible.
How do you manage that? Like what are you looking for on like different cultivars?
I mean, the big thing is your transpiration rate. Not only your daytime transpiration rate, but your overnight transpiration rate. You might have some plants that their transpiration rate overnight is just a straight line down. And then you have some that just sit.
And don't
transpire overnight. So then you can play with your irrigation schedule throughout the day, and the ones that don't transpire overnight and those feeds earlier, so then they can still get that nice slope back, and they're not drowning overnight.
And how do you like what's your process of monitoring that? Like what's your workflow on, say, if you get a new genetic or a new cultivar,
new genetic, new cultivar. I'll get the data back on, like, from our substrate monitors, which we're using GrowLink right now. I'll check it every day, every morning, every end of day, throughout the day. I'm on that thing constantly just checking and making sure, like, before the first feed in the morning, I'll check, make sure everybody got their dry backs overnight, make sure everything looks good. And then end of the day, I'll check it too to make sure we're on track.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on weather throughout the day, we'll check it. Because if it's, for us being mixed light, if it's cloudy or we get extra sun, I have to make all the time changes to the irrigation to either add hits, take away hits to keep everything happy.
With running the indoor spot in Shango and then moving up to like a mixed light greenhouse, like where do you lean towards?
I love mixed light greenhouse. I mean, I think I love it more or less for the challenge of it. It's for me more mentally stimulating. It's always we're constantly making changes every day.
Yep.
You know, because we got the other aspect of Mother Nature that we have to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, indoor you do have to make changes, but once you get a good recipe set, the majority of your crew's like cleaning all day, and you know what I'm saying? It's a lot more keeping stuff clean and pruned and manicured versus, you know, dialing in all these little environmental tweaks throughout the day and trying to keep everything as normal as possible in the greenhouse.
Yep. With irrigation strategy in a greenhouse, I mean, with the variables, are you always adjusting, you know, your irrigation times and staying on top of it constantly, or do you have a process of like what's your process on that?
So it depends on time of year. You know, summer and springtime, I can pretty much get a good schedule, set it, and then let it rip. As we're getting into winter and stuff, it's more of an everyday look at it because we get so many so many cloudy days out there. So it's just kind of playing with the weather and what's coming at us.
Okay. And are you writing things down? Like, how are you?
Yeah, I have notes and journals on pond journals, and I always take notes throughout the day. And then at the end of the week, I'll go through that notepad and then I'll highlight all my important stuff. And then I'll transfer it into like my final digital Bible of essential of like the hard good stuff, good data I want to keep for the week, so I can go back and look at it.
What are you mostly tracking when you're doing that on your notes?
I mean, the biggest thing is just plant health of the plants and the weeks they're in, and then kind of the external environmentals and internal.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of looking at all those. Are we seeing PM in a room? If we are, what's the humidity? What's the temps? What have the overnights been? And just kind of keeping that data so we can go and kind of figure out why we're having, you know, these reactions, and is it environmental? Is it something we're overfeeding? So it just helps keep track of all that.
How many times a day are you feeding for how long?
It depends. Depends. Right now, it's probably only like three to four times, and they're like 4 minute hits.
Okay.
So small hits throughout the day.
And what size dripper?
I think they're half gallon.
Half gallon
per minute. Yeah.
Okay, and then half gallon, 4 minutes. 3 to 4 times a day.
Yep.
And is that in summer or that's winter right now?
That's winter. Summer, some cultivars will take like 10 to 12 hits.
10 to 12 hits.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're almost tripling.
Tripling in the summer. But that's why
same 4 minutes.
Yep. And you'll see you've seen our yields over the years.
Yeah.
They double, triple in summer, spring. And
yep.
I mean, that's transpiring more, eating more.
Yep. So half gallon per minute drippers, and then what size pots?
We're about a gallon and a half.
Okay.
Yep.
Straight cocoa?
Straight cocoa.
Were you always a straight cocoa grower?
No, we were like, we did some heady living soil stuff, no-till beds, and then we had, you know, our pots and just organic soils. So I went from soil to cocoa.
Where are you leaning towards?
I mean, I like cocoa commercially 100% because there's less variables for stuff to happen.
You
have so many variables in living soil where you got to go, you know, send your soil out, get it tested, figure out, you know, what's off, what's causing all these factors. With cocoa, if you know you have a good base with it and then sterile, like, you know, it's, if you're having nutrient issues, it's the nutrients.
Yeah. Consistency.
Yeah.
And repeatability.
Yep.
With no-till, coming from no-till organic, were you guys straight organic or were you guys hybrid, like organic and synthetic?
No, we were full organic, making compost teas and like 1,000 gallon compost tea brewers. And
what do you lean towards now?
Synthetic.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, consistency.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not seeing any degradation in the product. Like, the product looks great, smells great. We have great terpenes. We're not getting cardboard terps. I think it's just all how you handle and process the flower.
Yeah. What's your thoughts on that? Like, where do you see a lot of cultivators kind of missing it on the quality in terpenes?
I think the biggest thing is just the curing and drying process. I think everybody's like in a rush to, you know, get to market or get their money back, and they're not taking that extra week to let it sit. They're not burping, and they're not, you know, putting it in a room where humidity and temps stay the same throughout the process.
Yeah. We learned that, on the new dryers that we built.
100%.
That was huge.
Yep.
That, like, what was crazy is, like, our dry rooms before were just janky, kind of.
They got the job done.
I mean, they got the job done, but you couldn't dial it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you seeing in the dry rooms, previous to now? Like, what are the major differences and improvements?
Just to keeping the environmentals in there. The old dry rooms would take a couple of days to get down to 60% humidity. And with the new ones, are down in the first day. The old ones would sit at like 80, 75 for a couple of days. Okay. That's where you get all that microbial growth and adds to all your fails as well with the labs.
But what I was so surprised is the increase in quality. Like, remember when we, like, the flower that we were doing was good. It was great.
Yeah.
You know? But then when we changed up the dry rooms, the whole pack stuck together.
Yeah, it got loud. We have sticky weed. I think it impresses a lot of people here in Nevada.
And the only thing we changed was the dry room.
That was it. And just, it's just keeping that environment where it should be from the start and not having it go from, you know, 90% humidity to 60 in 3 days. You want it there right away and, you know, help set up the curing process for those trichomes.
So you're saying it's really important to get to that 60% humidity right away.
Right away. Or pretty close. Like, I mean, if you're in the ballpark, but I feel like a lot of guys, you're sitting in a room, you don't have enough dehumidification, and you got a room full of plants and you're at 85% for 2 days before it gets down. Like, a lot of stuff can happen in 24 hours. The plant's still living, so I'm sure it's degrading a little bit and not curing and setting up.
What's your curing, like, temp, humidity, time? Like, what's your go-to?
Our dry time, we're usually around 7 to 10 days. We want to put it in there at, you know, at temp at 60, 59, humidity around 55.
Okay.
And then we'll just let it sit to the 7 to 10 days. We'll start the bucking process. But during the whole time when they're bucking and throughout all the other rooms, we have humidifiers in there too, so that humidity never goes any lower either. So we keep that humidity current throughout the whole back end process.
What's the setup like? What kind of humidity, dehues, AC? Like, what?
I know our dehumidifiers, I think we have about 4 Andens in there, and then we have ultrasonic humidifiers. And everything's all filtered and all set.
And you're just keep it,
don't change it, let it, just let it work its way out and finish.
I was blown away just the increase in quality.
Yeah, me too.
Was insane. I didn't understand. Like, I knew, like, the curing process is really important, right? But I didn't understand how big of an impact it made on terpenes and flavor and overall, you know, just flower quality. It's huge.
Yeah, it made a huge change.
Yeah.
And a quick one.
You've seen people, like, they'll harvest. They'll spend all this time and energy cultivating, and then they harvest in the same flower room or just like a open garage or, you know.
Yeah, they'll dry in their flower rooms.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's insane. You're running currently HPS 1000 watts.
Yes.
And then we did a test with 1000 watt LEDs, and on a DLI level on paper,
it looked great.
It was smashing HPS 1000 watts.
Yep.
On DLI. It was like 30-40% more.
Yep.
DLI. And we did 2 rows, right?
Yes.
Something like that. Put up 1000 watt LEDs that had 30-40% more DLI. And on paper, we're like, hey, that much more DLI, the yields are going to increase.
Yeah.
What did you see?
Decrease.
You saw a decrease?
Big decrease, yeah.
Did you see a decrease, or you saw the same as HPS? I thought it was the same.
It was pretty close to the same, but I would say the don't know, the quality of the way the nugs were set weren't, they're more spaced out, not as tight.
What do you like on an indoor? I mean, you see that kind of increase on LED, you're going to see that in yield major.
Right.
But in mixed light, what do you think? Like, what do you think your philosophy, like, what?
I think it's a big part of it too. Like we do rely on our canopy for that heat from the HPS for us, you know,
yep.
Not having that extra heat, it goes back to you're not transpiring as much.
So you think the leaf surface temperature was a big impact on
that? Yeah, 100%. And then you lose it instead of we noticed a big thing during that too, is we were feeding two times less on the LED rows than we were on the HPS rows.
Because the leaf surface temp.
Same strain, same everything. So you're getting two less feedings on a cycle. It's starts to add up.
Yeah, that was mind blowing. I was really, really surprised.
That's what we've always struggled with in the winter is our DLI, because we're losing that natural, any help from the sun after 4:30.
Yeah, but you also got a factor, you're losing the leaf surface temperature increase.
Yep.
Which transpiration,
yep.
Moving more.
So you tried it and same, but I think the HPS is definitely the move for greenhouse mixed light.
Is that go to, that's, you know, when you see LEDs in greenhouse, like,
I'm sure it can be done if you're in the, you got that perfect climate for it, you know, and there's
warmer
not,
climate.
Warmer climate. To increase the
leaf surface temperature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd have to.
Yeah. It's interesting because I thought we were going to crush.
So yeah, so did I.
Did you?
Yeah.
You thought so too, huh?
Yeah.
And
just getting the data back.
1,000-watt LED top light, it's insane. Yep. It's insane, the increase in DLI and PPFD.
Yep.
And we didn't see any difference.
No.
And you're saying less weight.
I would say, yeah. And overall, like, structure and quality, I would say less. Like, yeah. Weight, same. There wasn't, like, any weight difference, but the quality of the flower.
Did you guys use LEDs at Shingo?
No, we use HPS.
HPS?
Yeah.
Have you ran LEDs before or no?
Not solely, no.
So you're just straight HPS guy? Yeah, keep it real.
Yeah.
One thing that we worked on a lot this year was two main things. Lean farming practices and schedule. Like what do you think the biggest things we learned regarding those two subjects this year?
I mean, lean farming, I mean, we've learned a ton. I mean, I think every day we're still learning with it. It's a great principle to kind of bring into your facility and teach your staff like what the meaning behind it is, because then they'll start looking at things and, you know, every touch we can take away every day and get rid of is more time put to do other things. Like, we've seen it all throughout our facility by changing tiny little things. Like,
give me some examples.
We used to soak our 99 clone cubes, break them up, put them in trays. Now we're getting trays that are already pre-filled, and you're just feeding them, and you're not having to worry about all that extra prep work, and it saves days on the back end. Another big one we do is we veg in place now. You know, you lose couple days in those rooms, but we're able to turn a veg space into a flower room, and we're moving the plants when they're little, so you can move 2,000 plants on a baker's rack versus pushing carts all day back and forth moving plants.
So yeah, that was something that we did new this year, was veg in place. How do you think the overall canopy management and plant health is with vegging in place? How long are you vegging?
We're like 14 to 18 days, depending on time of year.
Okay.
We're still in the new stages of the canopy management with vegging in place. We're kind of learning as we go. It's not too bad. We've learned, you know, always want to keep a couple extras, because you're going to have some that don't make it and fall out. But other than that, it makes it super easy. I have the guys come in and top everything, so we try to keep everything at the same height. If need be, there's some strains we can let rip and not top, but
with topping, we've talked about it before on this podcast, and it's like topping, no topping. What have you learned?
It's just back and forth. I've done it both ways. It's
genetic dependent.
100% genetic dependent. I've seen stuff that I've topped and it looks great, and then I was like, well, I think you were there and you saw it, and we were walking through the room, and you're like, yeah, we got to top this one.
Yep.
And you top it, it looks fantastic. You let it go natural and it looks crazy.
Yep. Do you monitor that and write down the toppers and non-toppers?
Yep. Just keeping my nose.
And... Yep. And another thing we did was started to monitor stretchers, and we broke it into three different categories: stretchers, shorts, and mids.
Yep.
Right. And then that kind of tells you where you need to put your trellis netting.
100%.
Which is gaining tremendous amount of efficiencies.
Yeah, it turned a job that used to take them, you know, a day to set trellis in a room to, you know, one guy. It takes them like an hour or two to go through and set everything. And we have the sizes already marked out on the benches, so you just go.
You guys did do that?
Yep, and then we're adjusting it as we go through this first year run on it. So we'll have every quarter, obviously, throughout the season, the plant heights are going to change. So
because the climate,
our sizing is going to change. So trying to build them a guide for that now. So then they'll have it set throughout the year. So then every time we move in a room, they know, boom, set it, done. They don't have to worry about trellis until we harvest.
So that was one thing. How long? So the rooms are 7,200 square feet.
Yep.
Each room, except one of them. And we got eight rooms.
Yep.
One of the rooms is 11,000 square feet. One flower room.
It's the big one.
That was our old bedroom.
Yep.
That we converted into
the flower space.
Flower, because we veg in place. What with the trellis, how long is it taking a guy to do the full trellis in 7,200 square feet with what you're doing now?
With one guy and help with somebody for half a day, you're talking maybe 4 hours.
4 hours.
Yeah.
And that's in your marking. How many different marks do you have on your poles for your trellis?
So we'll have like three. So you have your short, medium, tall.
Okay. And based on what genetics going on that bench, you'll put the trellis at that point.
Yeah.
That's big.
Makes it super, super easy and just efficient for everybody. They don't have to go and look back or guess and manually slide the trellis down and spend all day trying to work plants in and just have the plants work their way, you know, throughout the trellis.
Yeah. How long is it taking you to harvest 7,200 square feet?
We just got it down to, I think we were like a little under 7 hours. They just broke a record last week.
How many people?
We had nine.
It's nine people at harvest.
Yeah. And that's including, there's some people just, you know, recording weights and moving racks and hanging stuff in the dry room. So that's, I want to say six or seven guys just cutting, everybody else just moving plants. And then
how many days are you down before you turn and burn?
Right now, just to keep everything on schedule, we're 6 days between turn and burn.
6 days?
Yeah.
What's taking 6 days? What's your process?
I think the majority of it, cleaning usually only takes them a day, day and a half. The big part is prepping cocoa.
Okay.
We get all our cocoa, you know, raw in blocks from Sri Lanka, and then we break them down and rehydrate them. So it takes us a couple of days to get that all set. And then after that, then we're good to go. That usually takes them about two and a half days.
With the cocoa?
With the cocoa, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But we just got that new mixer, so that should speed some stuff up.
Have you hooked up the potting machine yet?
No, not yet. They just got the cocoa machine hooked up before I left.
Yeah. What are some other efficiencies with lean farming? Like on a mindset level, like when you're dealing with a process or a workflow, like what are you thinking about?
I'm always thinking about just touches of like how many times, anytime, you know, we go and write new SOPs for something new, I'll make sure and go, you know, work with them, work through the flow. So then I can do stuff and just be like, okay, why did I touch that twice there to get it to here?
Yeah.
You know, if I can make it from here to there in one touch instead of two or three, how do we get rid of everything in between?
And did I teach you that?
Kind of a little bit. I think I had it in me. I think just brought it out more when I kind of understood deeper of the lean farming.
Yeah.
I mean, even on our old spot in California, like it was only the handful of us to run that whole thing. So that was just kind of how we were taught too, of like the less we can move something or touch something, it's going to make our 16-hour day a little bit easier.
Yeah. I think lean farming is a mindset.
100%.
It's a mindset. Like you're looking every time you're in that facility, like you said, it's really important for leadership to work with their people. Because if you're not down there doing the workflow and the process, you're not seeing the inefficiencies.
Right.
But as leadership, you're always I bet like when you go into a, when the team is working, like the way my brain works is I'm always thinking, I'm always watching, I'm watching how, where are they walking? Like how far is that distance? Yeah. Where's the tools at? Like how many times are they touching a process? How can we lean it down? Like what can we do? And then you go there and you test it yourself. Yep. You do the labor and you're like, oh, this works. Hey guys, what do you think about this? Right? Like, right. Do you guys think this is a good idea? And let's try it and see how much time we've saved. Like how, like from last year, the 2023 to 2024, like on what are some, like how many days do you think we've saved? How much man hours? Like,
I mean, months.
Months. Yeah.
Yeah. We were at one point, we were like two months behind, and then we added a whole bunch of new efficiencies, added maybe one more person on the team, and we got caught up.
Months in labor.
Yeah. And it's always, just like you said, it's always taking the time, making sure, checking in on them, you know, and looking, working with them to see like, okay, how can we make this more efficient or make them even understand? They could be doing a process like pruning, and I can have a technique that I could show them that makes more sense in their mind and make them more efficient, so they're not taking their time on plants. And, you know, every time, even when someone starts in the greenhouse and we're pruning, I'll give them a timer or a stopwatch, and I'll be like, make sure this is what we want to do, but make sure you're not spending more than 2 minutes on this plant.
Because if they get it, good.
two minutes on a plant per of our benches, one person can finish a bench and a half in a day. So if you can keep them on pace, but keep them so they're not, you can easily get lost in pruning a plant. You know, as being someone in a greenhouse, you could stay and manicure a plant all day. So if you put a limit and then they kind of see what they're getting done in that time frame, and then it gives them a good base of how to get everything done.
That's big.
Yeah.
I like that.
You know. And they don't need the stopwatch all the time, but it just give them a mental.
Well, yeah, you can kind of mentally feel what two minutes
feels like. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd be like, okay.
So you're not getting stuck.
And then
stuck.
You can take those minutes, break it down on the day and know what you're going to get out and how many guys you need.
Yep. To get that room done.
And you know, how long is it taking you to strip a room?
Right now, maybe like 2 days.
Okay. How many guys?
Between 4 and 6.
Okay. So you're stripping, 7,200 square feet. How many plants?
Roughly, we're like 24 to 2,600, depending.
2,600 plants with 4 people in 2 days.
Yep.
Yeah, if you didn't have those metrics broken down in minutes, you wouldn't know how many employees you would need. You wouldn't know. There's so many different things. And also, you can kind of track on...
who's good at what.
Exactly.
Or not, let's say, more efficient in other areas. I could have somebody that's way more efficient pruning, but isn't efficient in filling pots.
Yeah.
Or moving pots. You know what I'm saying? So I use that as a big thing too, is kind of see where everybody's strengths are and keep those people together in the facility. And, you know, it's a big improvement on workflow. And
yeah. Yeah. We've gotten really, really efficient.
Yeah.
I think post-harvest, we're currently at what, like $35 a pound?
Yeah.
What does that include? $35 a pound for post-harvest. That's
trim, packaged, labeled, ready to go out the door.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Like 30. And that was before the packaging machine.
Yeah, that was before the machine.
What do you think you can get post-harvest down to total labor in a bag?
I mean, because you think our packaging is probably 70% of that $35. So.
Yeah.
I mean, probably under 20 bucks.
20 bucks.
17 to 20.
Yeah.
Easy. Once we get that machine fully cranking, but.
Yeah. No, it's a big deal. Another thing that we really worked on this year is schedule. Like the important, like how to you, how important is the schedule for a cultivation?
I mean, it's everything. Like it's the heartbeat.
It's everything.
You know, I always tell my guys, if we ever get behind in areas, there's some things that we could push back a couple of days and move around, but the two things we can never push back, cutting clones, moving in, and harvesting. Like those dates need to stay set. If you miss a day or two late on pruning in the middle, not the end of the world, but being a day or two late on that harvest or be a day or two late on cutting clones, that puts everything back for the whole, you know, the whole year.
So what, so harvest, cutting clones, and moving in?
Yeah. Are the,
they're the three
hard dates that don't, you know, we don't miss those dates.
How are you managing your schedule right now?
Right now, we developed what is Airtable that we're using. It works great. You know, we have it all scheduled, mapped out for into next year, year and a half almost.
Yeah. For a whole year.
Yeah.
You mapped out a whole, we mapped out a whole year. And what are you tracking or what are you scheduling inside Airtable?
I mean, everything from cutting clones, clean out of the room, moving in, throwing in their tasks for, let's say, day 21 prune, day 42 prune, throwing those in there. Any task-related goals we have for that room is all in Airtable. So as I come through, like, it's easy, too, for us. Like, you look at the month, I have everybody's workflow essentially done for the month. You know, I just go in there, double-check, make sure. It allows me to put people where, you know, they need to be and stay on point with everything.
What I found really cool was we did the 2025 schedule.
Yep.
On Airtable. And then we, in Airtable, it breaks it down into, you know, you can see the time and kind of break down and you can see where you could fit another harvest.
Yes.
You know, walk, how did we do that? Like, walk us through that process.
I mean, it was the way it lays it out.
Visually, you can see the spacing the block, on Airtable. Yeah,
blocked out. So
you could see the flower time, veg time, harvest, takedown and cleanup and, you know, transition.
So it made it really easy for us to just look. And like, we could physically see where we had a you know, a 10-day gap where we could fit something versus having to just look at a list of numbers and be like, okay, how many days back can we slide this in?
Yep.
So yeah, super game changer.
How much will that one harvest generate in revenue?
One harvest, room outside, I mean, over a couple hundred grand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, schedules everything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm surprised, you know, when I go into some cultivations, I don't see a tight schedule. Like, you got to live and die by the schedule.
100%. Because, you know, it normally takes you 6 days to clean a room, and in the middle of the year, for some reason, something happens, and it takes you 2 weeks to flip that room. You just lost probably a harvest and a half for the year.
Yep.
I mean, that's another cool thing about Airtable. It will show you, because, like, we have that 11,000 square foot room that takes us a little longer to clean. It shows you what that 2-3 days will do over the year as far as pushing the schedule back. And making stuff catch up to other things.
Yeah.
So it's super dope.
Yeah. No, it's big. With HLVD, like you've experienced, I go into the facility and I know you've kept it really clean and, we've had HLVD in the past, but I don't see you ever having it. Like, I mean, I'm sure you come across it, but I never spot it.
Yeah, I try to get it out of there as quick as possible. We had it when I first got there. It was pretty bad. I got spread everywhere.
Yep.
And then after that, it's just kind of writing out the SOPs for whoever's working in mom and veg and really keeping a tight ship on that stuff. If we have stuff in there that isn't tested yet, there's a rule like no one's touching or topping it before we go get it tested. Just to stop an easy spread, because all it takes is one dirty one.
Yep. With what's your process on that? What's your SOP of monitoring?
Monitoring. I mean, big thing monitoring. You're looking at structure when you're letting them veg. You know, you let them veg for 2 months, and you're looking at the bottom branches. Are they going straight out? I mean, you'll notice it. They'll just go.
Are they going flat?
Yeah, they'll go flat and crazy. Yep. And then there's like the stress test we call it. Like you just tap the branch and that thing will fold and break. And then we'll send it out to I think we use my Florida DNA to do all our HLVD testing. So quarterly, I'll test all our moms. Anytime we get anything new in, we test it before we put it into production just to stop that threat of spreading it.
Yeah. No. And how often are you testing?
Probably quarterly. Unless, yeah. Or if we get some new stuff in that before we take cuts off of it, we want to make sure.
Yeah. No, it's a big deal.
And then just keeping everything clean with bleach. You know, we use a little higher concentrate than normal for our scissors and stuff when we're in the clone and mom room. And But that's an all good reason because we want to make sure we're not spreading it.
So you're dipping your scissors before you move to each plant.
Yeah. So they're whoever, let's say they're cutting clones. Whoever's cutting clones, they're keeping three pairs of scissors in a cup of bleach as they're working through. That way they're rotating through the scissors and that the pair of scissors is sitting in that cup of bleach long enough to get the full disinfectant.
Yep. How many harvests are you doing a month?
Right now we're at like 2 to 3. Going into this next year, we're going to be at like a 2-3-4 rotation.
And what are you pulling grams per square feet right now?
I'd have to do the math on that, but
it's about 20.
Is it?
I think it's about 20. Yeah. Do you think indoor, you know, I used to pull 60 to 70 grams of quality flower consistently, you know? On indoor.
Yeah.
But greenhouse, I mean, it seems like in winter, it's like 19 to 20 grams a square foot.
100%.
And then in summer, it's like max 30 to 35.
Right. Yep.
Like I've heard some wild numbers on grams per square foot in a greenhouse what's average you're seeing in greenhouse cultivation?
I mean, I just like kind of where we're at, anywhere between 20 and like 40. You have people that, you know, there's always going to be outliers, but then you have to ask the question of like, is it full of botrytis and are you passing testing?
Yeah.
Because we can't grow big. If you grow big monsters in a greenhouse, you're going to get botrytis. You're going to get bud rot. You have to, you know, we have the environmentals that we have to deal with, and, you know, Mother Nature's not always nice. So you start putting huge monster colas in a greenhouse, it's only.
Yeah.
Recipe for disaster eventually.
Yeah. How are you keeping your night humidity down?
Right now, we're running dehumidifiers in our greenhouses overnight.
That was
a big improvement we made.
Yeah. Are you seeing an increase in plant health when you're doing that as well?
Yeah, 100%.
Lowering the humidity at night?
Yeah. We're seeing huge. And for us, like being out there, like we're in the high desert, so you would think we wouldn't need dehumidification, but in the winter months, just it's so cool and we need it at night. It makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I always did greenhouse with no dehu.
Yeah, same.
You too?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that the first time you used dehus?
Yeah, in a greenhouse. But as we were, you know, trialing it out, I saw where it could be useful, you know, as we were kind of talking through it.
Yeah.
It just made sense because you'd watch, same thing collecting data, you'd watch the graphs, you watch overnight, you watch that humidity spike every night to 78%, 80%, 82%.
The plants are getting better dry back.
Yep, and now they're getting better dry back because the humidity is where it needs to be, and it's not too humid in there for them to not transpire. And
yeah, I mean we're at 4,500 feet elevation. Humidities are average 15 to 19%.
Yep.
And like you said, you don't think you'll need a dehu with humidities that low, but it changed the game.
Yeah, huge. And helps too with the little monsoons we do get. But when we get monsoons, that humidity goes up to like 90% in there quick.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yep.
With the two harvests, how's your guys' sell-through right now for the Nevada market?
We're blessed right now. As far as sell-through, it's good. You know, essentially, they're waiting on us to package.
Even with the three harvests, like you got just consistent sell through.
We haven't got to three yet, but yeah, once we do, I don't see it being an issue.
Yeah. How do you think the Nevada market is right now?
It's different. I think there's a lot of, unfortunately, I'm just going to say it, not a lot of quality flower in Nevada. So you're starting to see a lot of fall through, and you know, the quality brands are starting to stick around and really show out. And stay current for the, you know, the end consumer. But the markets, I don't know, it's all over the place right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big tourist market too. So it's like a hard.
What do you think that it's from? Talent density out here or climate, heat? What?
I think it's a little bit of everything and above. Yeah. And just, you know, people just trying to get product out to the market quick, and they know.
Not curing it properly, drying it too fast.
Not curing it properly, not storing it properly. Fortunately, you get a lot of these dispensaries and you spend $50, $60 on an eighth and you get it and it's, you don't even need a grinder. You can just grind it in your hand in the dust.
Yeah.
It's because it's just not being stored properly.
Yeah. where do you like to see your humidity levels when you're packaging on your flower?
You usually try to keep it like between 55 and 50.
Yeah. And your moisture level on your flower?
Like 10 to 12 as we're going into packaging. That way, when it does, if it does go to the dispensary or does sit somewhere that the humidity is not proper for a couple of days, still gives it a chance to get to the consumer at a good moisture content.
Yeah, that was one thing. I remember you telling me a story of a smoker, somebody that buying our flower was like, oh, can actually.
Yeah, feel the mold.
What, feel the what?
He's like, yeah, he's like feeling how moldy it is because it was like squishy.
Yeah, it was squishy.
Because he wasn't educated. I was like, that's not mold. That's, it should be squishy and sticky.
Oh, he thought it was mold?
He thought it was like rot, like no good because it wasn't hard.
Because it wasn't like.
Yeah, it wasn't rock hard. Yeah, yeah.
Was it falling apart?
Yeah, he had no idea. He never felt squishy weed before.
Yeah.
Which is wild.
That's so wild. That is wild.
It's a lot of educating to the consumers, even the local consumers. It's just, they're starting to get there where, like, you know, trying to get them more educated on terpenes and not this battle of like 31% THC is king.
Yeah. 100. Are you seeing it's just still THC dominated? Or
unfortunately. Yeah. I think it just has to do with we're such a big tourist market.
Yeah.
Because you got, I mean, all these people coming, different states, different countries. The easiest thing for them to look at out of all those numbers is going to be THC.
Yeah. I personally, I like the RS11.
Yeah.
Load testing is where I go.
That's where I'm at too. I don't know if I'm getting old or everything I smoke now, it's fire. It ends up coming back at like 16 to 18.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to get blitzed.
Yeah. No, me neither.
I want to smoke a little, enjoy my time, chill.
Be able to function throughout the day. So I think hopefully that market will start to come along and better as we educate people. I know like we've been doing too, like we've given out a ton of that RS11 as samples to people and everybody loves it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's some of our lowest testing flower.
Yeah. And so it's like getting,
it's my favorite to smoke.
Yeah. Mine too. And it's like getting them accustomed, like, okay, it's okay to smoke something that's out of 14%. It's not, you're not going to have a bad time.
Yeah.
You're going to get high.
Yeah.
You're going to enjoy yourself. You're not getting screwed over. Like, I think that's what a lot of people think in the market here of like, if it's not high THC, they're getting taken advantage of.
No. Versus some of the best flowers, low testing.
100%.
LCG is 16,
yep.
17%.
And you're either going to have terpenes or THC. So it's very rare you're going to see high numbers on both unless they're doing something.
Yeah. One thing about you is you're always pheno hunting.
Yes.
Like you're a monster. Like what do you got going right now? Like how many are you popping? How many seeds are you popping at a time? Like what crosses are you running?
Right now we just finished up a big coffin candy one that we worked on for over a year and a half that we got from like 230 phenos down to 31. And then we just got test results back. So we finally got that down to like the final 9.
So out of 231, you picked 9?
Yeah.
Okay.
So finally got those back and then just started a new one. Just did over, I think it's over 180 seeds and they're all amaretto crosses from Symbiotic.
Oh, yep.
So that'll be a fun one.
How many pheno hunts are you doing a year?
I'll try either one. Like we did one big one. I'm probably going to start breaking them down into smaller ones throughout the year. Now as we've added this space too, I have a little bit more small benches to play on because obviously pheno hunting, we want to do it in the smallest area possible because that's real estate that, you know, you can lose out on.
Yeah. What breeders are you popping?
Right now I did, the last one was Symbiotics and Compound.
Okay.
And we have a bunch of stuff from them.
With pheno hunts, like as far as, are you seeing a lot of cultivation facilities in Nevada pheno hunt, or they're just
some
running?
I think a lot of them are running, and unfortunately, they're not only running but they're renaming.
Yeah, I see that a lot.
Like there's people that have 5 or 6 lemon cherry gelato on their menu.
Yeah, how important do you think it is for a facility to continuously pheno hunt?
I think now the way this industry is going, you have to. Like you have to have either that strain that makes you stand out, because if you're in a market where there's a hot strain, you know, that we all can cultivate well, and you go to that market, you go to the dispensary, now you have 12 grows all growing the same thing. So finding that, it helps you find that diversity for your, you know, one, your brand, and then two, the consumer.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. with the crosses that you're doing right now, out of the nine, like what were you looking for with those hunts?
For me, it's I'm always going after like terpenes, the nose, and then obviously the other things that follow behind that is like the nose on it, and then the smokeability of like the translation to the nose is like my number one, right? And then after that, structure, is it going to yield? How difficult is it to grow? Because you get some strains that are fire, but on a commercial level, unfortunately, they're not viable.
Yeah, and obviously THC numbers.
Yep.
Unfortunately, THC, yep. You know, I wish it wasn't like that. You know, it's rough because we got to throw a lot of fire away.
Yeah. There's a lot of genetics. I mean, I it's not even just us. It's probably a ton of people all over the country and world that are just like, they're getting these cuts or finding these phenos of something that tastes, smells amazing, hitting 14%, and then it goes in the trash.
Yeah.
And we're never going to see it again.
Yeah. Because you can't sell it.
Yep.
Yeah. It's crazy. Do you think that's why you have so much sell through in Nevada? Because, I mean, and we can't keep inventory in stock.
Yeah. I would say so. That too. And just like our overall, like, passionate actually care for the products throughout the process. Like we make sure, like we want to make sure our stuff's going out at its best quality to the consumer. Yep. You know, as far as we're not sending out a bunch of dry stuff, we're keeping everything.
Terploc bags.
Use Terploc bags. We're creating a product that we want to smoke.
Yeah. You know, with your experience on large scale greenhouse mixed light cultivation, like what's some advice that you would give some other, you know, mixed light greenhouse guys?
Don't be scared to try new things in the greenhouse. Also, if I can just take notes, a lot of notes. Unfortunately, with greenhouse, the big disadvantage we have versus indoor guys is I only get one shot a year during that time of the year to try to make adjustments. So in the winter, if I see something happen and I have to wait till the next winter to make that adjustment, whether it's closing blackouts early or messing with heaters and settings. So just keep those notes and just always revisit it throughout the seasons.
Yep. Cool, man. Back to MJ. You going to this show?
Yeah, I'm going to go look at some stuff.
Yeah. Did you go out last night?
Nope.
No?
A little bit.
I did. I'm good.
Trying to behave until tonight.
Yeah. You going to Connect tonight?
I think so, yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Right on. All right, brother.
All right, brother.
I appreciate you coming
on. Yes, sir.
Yeah, it was good. Hopefully some growers learn something from this.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right, man.
All right, brother.